Game on 2FM. With Green Farm, a nourishing addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry, or snack. Natural protein, your way.
Thank you very much to Jenny and the team. It is Thursday, the 1st of July. You're very welcome to Game On. Coming up today, Didi Hamann and his old boss, Rafa Benitez, who is now Ireland's Seamus Coleman's new boss.
And I know the Everton fan base that I know and that I've been playing for all these years have got a massive respect for people and they love their football club. So I think it will be very unfair to judge the Everton fans or the Everton supporters on one banner or two banners that have been seen, because that can be a minority of people.
We're going to do an amnesty for Everton fans. If you're happy with Benitez, let us know. If you're unhappy, equally, we will give you a conduit to vent. We're live to Mount Juliet for the latest on day one at the Irish Open, and fair to say it has been a mixed day for the Irish.
It's 72 holes for everybody, so I think that you've got to take your chances. And some of these lesser lights, you know, they're coming in here. You've seen it on the leaderboard. You know, there's a lot of names there that wouldn't necessarily be very familiar with. But having said that, over four rounds, the stronger players will always come to the top.
Ian O'Riordan of the Irish Times is soon to be on Tokyo Time. He'll be in studio with me to update us on this month's Olympic Games and the latest Team Ireland qualifiers. And we're also going to check in stateside with Jeff Shepherd ahead of Independence Day.
Game on 2FM.
You're welcome to the programme, 51552 for your text. You can tweet us at GameOn2FM. And delighted to say Ian is with me in studio. Ian, how are you?
Yeah, good evening, Damien.
This month's Olympic Games.
Yeah, just when you said July the 1st there, it dawned on me. So that's what, 21 days ago?
And the 23rd is the opening ceremony.
Yeah, so 22 days. And you know, no one does Olympic countdowns, or countdowns like the Olympics, but this one has been like, 5 years almost waiting at this stage. And this is the final run-in. And obviously the final cut-off day for qualification was midnight on Tuesday. A few athletes left it very late. Mark English in particular ran his 800-metre qualifying time literally with hours to spare, 144.71. So we were just talking there before we came on air. What is it, about 103 athletes overall?
It's certainly, I was looking at the Olympic Federation of Ireland, who, to be fair to them, are brilliant at updating, you know, their stats and everything else. So they have it at 103 athletes qualified, 7 horses, 59 named athletes across 19 sports.
Yeah. Well, the 19 sports is definitely a record. I think maybe 15 or 16 before would be the you know, it's a great variety, diversity there. And dare I say, quite a few medal hopes too. I don't think it would be unreasonable to expect a few medals from that team.
And like I've, you know, you often, like you're preparing for your fifth games. I've been lucky enough to be at two. And you do, the natural inclination is we all get obsessed with the Olympics for a couple of weeks while it's on. And it's like, oh, well, it was a bad Olympics because we only won 2 medals and we won 3. And it's like, no, hang on a second. Look at the personal best. Mm. Look at the, like Tom Barr finishing 4th in a you know, final in Rio was as good an achievement as other people winning a medal. You know what I mean? That we're disproportionate in how we assess it. But it is one we can really go with great anticipation.
Yeah, I think at the same time, like, it's important sometimes to talk up our chances. Sometimes players or athletes talk down their chances. And I think there's a bit of a shift in mindset there. I mean, looking at the team, the likes of Reece McLennan, for example, in gymnastics, I mean, he's gone out there utterly believing he can win the gold medal. Obviously, the rowers now, we've seen what, you know, we've seen what O'Donovan and Fintan McCarthy have done now in that boat. Like, they've really laid down the claim. But yeah, I mean, I wouldn't get obsessed with the medals, but it's nice to have that in the back of the mind. And of course, there is still that big pandemic COVID-19 cloud hanging over the whole thing. I mean, they still haven't decided yet whether they're going to actually let spectators in officially or not, because numbers are rising up there again. So I mean, we were talking earlier on, like, it's going to be touch and go for a lot of events as well, whether they actually complete it on time, whether ever athlete even gets to compete on the stage. And you can only imagine what that's going to be like, four or 5 years of preparing.
But it is, like, so we're talking about Friday, 3 weeks is the opening ceremony. Are we, like, in my mind, we've long gone beyond the point where there was a question mark over whether or not it was going to happen. Like, I don't want to be cynical. I don't want to bring it back to the base level of finances. But there is too much money at stake for the key stakeholders for this not to happen. That, in my mind, it was always going to happen, largely on financial reasons more than anything else. So we can put to bed the debate over whether or not it's going to happen. We're this close to it at this stage.
Absolutely,
definitely. But it is inevitable that you are going to have an athlete who's going to, you know, injuries are part and parcel of it, but we will have the inevitability of an athlete who progresses through the judo or the rhythmic artistic gymnastics or whatever it is and then misses the medal round because of COVID and or a close contact. Or, like, look at the two England guys last week. You're 90 seconds too long standing with somebody and all of a sudden it's going to be
Yes.
It's going to be part of the tragedy of it, I think.
Yeah, I think they're already calling it the games with no fun as opposed to all the fun and games. But we'll see. But I think, I mean, you know as well, trying to get out there. I mean, I don't know how many COVID forms or COVID sort of whereabouts types things be filled out in advance. That's even before we get there. And I think they are going to have to be extremely vigilant for a variety of reasons. But I've been to Tokyo before. I mean, it's a city of 24 million people in this overall area. So, like, it's still going to be kind of a drop in the ocean. I don't think it's going to be like London where you really felt like it took over the city and maybe even Rio to some extent. Like, Tokyo is a vast, vast city, and I think they, you know, it's not going to be the sort of super spreader that they're talking about, touch wood. But anyway, I'd read it's a nervous time for the athletes, whether they've qualified or not. Until you're actually, dare I say, on your starting line for your event, you can't really relax.
We'll chat more about the Olympics later on in the program, but just looking of again this bounty of sporting events that are ongoing. We've a rest day in Euro 2020, we've the Irish Open, which we're going to check in with Greg later on in the programme. The lead is at 8 under par. Lucas Herbert leading by 2 shots. A lot of players still on course. Colin Moriarty, 4 under par with 16 holes played, best of the Irish so far. Shane Lowry in the club has 2 under. Niall Kearney, 1 under. Paul Dunne and Rory McIlroy, level par. I won't go through all the Irish competitors because I would be here between now and 7 o'clock. That's ongoing. Wimbledon is ongoing. The Tour de France is ongoing. And a remarkable story in terms of Mark Cavendish, his 32nd Tour de France stage win today. This, like, cyclists have had phenomenal careers and haven't ridden 32 stages of the Tour, let alone won it. Too short of Eddie Merckx now. And only there because Sam Bennett's not. It's a bizarre story.
It's a twisted, ironic story, isn't it? And you couldn't script this. And funnily enough, I remember the press conference at the start of the year because I was doing a lot of cycling at the time because there wasn't a whole lot else on. And they actually unveiled Mark Cavendish alongside Sam Bennett at the kind of quick step team launch. And if you said to me back then, well, actually, Sam Bennett's not going to ride the Tour. Mark Cavendish is going to come back at the age of 36, win 2 stages only within the first week. He's taken over the green jersey. He's closing in on Eddie Merckx's record 34 stage wins. He's 36 years old. You know, I would have laughed out the gate. And you got the backdrop then at the whole kind of manager standoff with Sam Bennett and his manager Patrick Lefebvre at the kind of quick step, which has actually got quite ugly. He's been kind of questioning Bennett's mental fortitude and all this kind of stuff. So, look, I mean, I don't think Sam Bennett's an envious kind of guy, and I know he's extremely determined and he will be back, but it can't be easy watching your kind of understudy to some extent this year come out and win 2 stages and take over the green jersey, get all the plaudits, and he's sitting at home wondering, what have I done to deserve
just,
this?
You know, you mentioned there the row between, like, Sam Bennett has withdrew in advance and put it down to injury. The team owner and manager has obviously questioned that. It's become now not even a war of words in the media because it's a one-sided lambasting of Sam Bennett by the principal of the team. And you talk about, it's like the irony of all ironies to question someone's mental fortitude and then initiate a massive pylon over his mental well-being and everything else. Like, it's,
I don't know how he gets
completely
away with,
irresponsible.
Yeah. I mean, if that was any other sport, imagine that was happening, GA manager turning around and saying, "Oh, my player's weak, you know, weak, and he's faking injury and this kind of stuff." You'd be hung out for it. But by the way, Patrick Lefebvre, he's got history here. This is a style. Sometimes it works. You know, he's known for kind of kissing riders when they're up and kicking them when they're down. That's a style. I mean, last year he was saying Sam Bennett was indestructible. These kind of words, you know. So he does kind of, that's his style. But certainly when you go the opposite, it's a dangerous game to play. And I really feel for Sam Bennett. He will be back. If there's one positive to take out of the Mark Cavendish story, is that he's 36 years old. Bennett's only what, 30, so he's got another maybe 5-6 years at that level if he can keep injury free. Because it goes to show that you can't unlearn the things that it takes to win a bunch sprint. And Mark Cavendish certainly showed that over the last couple of days.
Okay. Much more to come from Ian later on in the program. We're going to hear from Didi Hamann shortly as well, and as mentioned, Greg is live at the Dubai Duty Free Irish Open. So all of that to come. Rugby news today, coverage of Ireland's test against Japan on both RTE television and RTE radio this coming weekend. Joey Carberry in line to make his first Ireland appearance since the 2019 World Cup. His problems with injury well documented at this stage. He's been named in the Ireland team to face Japan. James Ryan will captain the side after overcoming an injury. He's set to be partnered in the second row. The Irish team in full, Hugo Keenan at full back, Jordan Larmour and Jacob Stockdale on the wings, Chris Farrell, Stuart McCluskey in the centre, Joey Carberry, Jemison Gibson-Park at half back, Dave Kilcoyne, Ronan Kelleher, Finlay Beelam in the front row, Ulton Delan, James Ryan in the second row, Peter O'Mahony, Josh Van der Fleer and Caelan Doris in the back row. Here's the Ireland head coach, Andy Farrell.
This is a proper test match. First and foremost, we're playing against a top class side in Japan. We all know the last time that we played them, and we've since seen the two games that they've had, the hit out that they've had against the Sunwolves and against the Lions. They're a formidable side that's very experienced, and by all reports, they've been together for 6 weeks now. It's a big block. We've been together for 12 days. Come match day, that's not us complaining, because that's the world that we're living in the Northern Hemisphere, and that's what we've got to be good at. You know, coming up to speed, and I suppose that's the challenge for this side. But if you look at the Japanese side, I thought they was the best prepared team in the World Cup, bar none. And the performances showed that. Well, first and foremost, I mean, it's been a delight to be involved in the group. You know, such a diverse group, such a different group to what we've been used to in the past. And the opportunities are fantastic for us. You've got new guys coming in that you're seeing them trying to find the feet and find the way within the group. You've got guys that's on 4 or 5 caps. Trying to come in, and they look like the experienced guys, and some of those guys now are becoming leaders, and that'll stand to us as well. And you've got other guys that are coming in that have probably felt out done by in the past. They've probably gone home on occasions in Six Nations weeks, etc., and been desperate for a chance, and this is the chance.
That's Andy Farrell chatting earlier today. We're going to press on with soccer. As mentioned, we've got Euro 2020 set to, you know, get underway yet again. A couple of days rest for the players in advance of the semi-finals later on this week. The transfer news starting to build up as well, and a significant managerial appointment with a club that I know has many followers in this country, Everton. A lot to chat to. Delighted to say we're joined by former Liverpool player, a former German international, and a big part of RTE's coverage of Euro 2020 so far. Dietmar Hamann is with us. Didi, how are you?
I am good, thank you. How are you?
Very good. It's good to talk to you. Thanks for your time, as always. An awful lot to get stuck into. We'll chat about Rafa Benitez and Everton in a moment, but the other big piece of transfer news today, Manchester United confirming that they've agreed in principle the signing of Jadon Sancho for £85 million. I know you cover an awful lot of Bundesliga of late. How good a player are United getting, and is this a good bit of business from them?
Yeah, brilliant. He's been absolutely sensational the last 2 years. Came from Manchester City. I think it cost less than £10 million. And he really made an impact in Germany. He's a brilliant player. I'm very surprised that Gareth Southgate doesn't call upon him. Because I think with all the talent England's got, I still think that there should be a place for Sancho. At the moment, there's not, but I think Manchester United get a brilliant player.
And when we look at, you know, like Manchester United, undoubtedly, irrespective of where they are in the league table, are one of the biggest clubs in the world. It's obviously been a difficult couple of seasons for them. This is a player that was highly sought after by a number of clubs. How big a signing is it for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as manager?
Well, I think it's very important because, as you've seen, as well as they did last year, I think they still lacked a little bit when it comes to challenging Manchester City and obviously Liverpool, because Liverpool had a lot of injuries last year. So I think they needed reinforcement. And I think he's one of the best English players at the moment. And to get him, I think, is a big statement. I don't think Sancho is enough to challenge for the league for Manchester United, but I think it's a big step forward.
Okay, the other big news today, Rafa Benitez. This has long been a case of when he would be confirmed as the Everton manager rather than if he would be confirmed as the Everton manager. Obviously, Carlo Ancelotti leaving very suddenly. When you look at Benitez's CV, it's a big, big appointment for Everton, but then it's obviously complicated by the fact that for an awful lot of people, they're not going to be happy that the man that led their biggest enemy to the Champions League is now in charge of Goodison Park.
Yeah, and I can understand both sets of fans. But I was a bit surprised because there was a lot of sentiment from Everton fans saying, you know, we don't want him here, don't come here. I think he will be loved by the Everton faithful. I think the man is a top-class manager. I think he's a genius when it comes to managing clubs. If you look at his track record, what he did at Newcastle, what he did at Chelsea when he had a lot of fans against him when he first took over, you know, he's just a brilliant manager. And I think Liverpool fans obviously don't take it too well. But I think the Everton fans, in about 6 months' time, they will speak differently about him and maybe regret some of the things they do say now, because he's a brilliant manager. And I know it's a tricky situation. But then again, he's been to China. He wants to manage back in the Premier League. And if there's no other club where he can go to, I wouldn't hold it against him. I know about the situation, how sensitive it is in Liverpool. But as I said, I wouldn't hold it against him. He left Liverpool a long time ago, and I think he'll do very well for Everton.
The Republic of Ireland captain, Seamus Coleman, will return to pre-season training on Monday. He was on media duty today as part of the launch of the Spar Better Choices programme. He's been chatting to the media. Let's hear what he's had to say about the appointment of Rafa Benitez at Goodison Park.
No, listen, we understand how the fans feel about their football club, and that there's been a bit of unrest amongst the fans. We understand that, and but I also know Everton fans. I know how they work. I know that once the manager would have signed that contract, they will back him 100%. And once he gets in the stadium, they'll back him, and he'll get a great reception. And as players, we're all going to go back. Look forward to going back and trying to be as prepared as we possibly can to make sure that we're in his plans come the first game of the season, and try and impress him as much as we can. And he's got a track record of winning trophies as well, which is good for players to see as well. I'm due to speak to him over the next few days, but we're back at work on Monday as well, so I'm sure we'll all catch up properly then, and we'll get over there and work hard and try our best to, as I said, be in his plans and see what the future holds for us all. There's clubs, every club has got some fans that will overstep the mark in some regard. And yet, you know, some of the banners that, you know, weren't ideal. But I think that's a small minority. You don't even know who that was. You don't know how old these people are. You don't know how connected they are to the football club. I think when kind of things happen in football like this, you know, these things come across as very big news, but you actually don't know. Is that a small group of people? Is it one person? You know, you don't know, but it looks like it's the whole fan base, because I know the Everton fan base are a good bunch of people. They're really respectful, really hardworking, love their football club. And I know the Everton fan base that I know and that I've been playing for all these years have got a massive respect for people, and they love their football club. So I think it'll be very unfair to judge the Everton fans or the Everton supporters on one banner or two banners that have been seen, because that can be a minority of people, and we don't even know how connected, how often they go to the games. We don't know anything about the people who put them banners, so I think it'll be too early to judge who put them banners out there and how connected they are with the football club. And I do agree that the Everton fans will back and support the manager once the decision has been made.
That's Seamus Coleman chatting earlier. Didi, before we let you go, obviously the resumption of Euro 2020 tomorrow, Belgium, Italy, the first of the quarterfinals, Switzerland, Spain, obviously in action as well tomorrow. Then the other side of the draw, Ukraine, England, Czech Republic against Denmark. How wide open a tournament do you see it being still?
It's wide open, but at the same time, you've got to say that one half of the draw obviously opened up a lot more than the other half. You've got three out of the four closest challengers on one side. England on the other side, you know, are still... I think England's got a long way to go. They should beat Ukraine, but then again, they've got a tough game against Denmark or Czech Republic, probably Denmark. What I don't like about England is that Southgate's been cautious at the best of times. I think the setup against Germany was negative. I know they won the game. It's hard to argue with his setup when you do win. But I think at some stage, if we were to go behind, I do worry whether they've got the answers to come back. And on the other side of the draw, I do like Spain. I've got to say they probably got the easier game against Switzerland. The heroic effort against France to come back from two goals down. So I do like Spain on the other half. I probably think that Belgium will get the better of Italy. I'm still not convinced about them. But it makes up for a great quarterfinal, semifinal and final. As you said, it's wide open and, remains to be seen. But I'd be very surprised if England got all the answers when it comes to the crunch to win the title.
And I know, like, we can play hypothetical situations, but would you much rather be if you're one of the teams in the tougher side, does that stand to you better as you progress, or are you better to be on the weaker side and be able to, you know, now taper your preparation and form for the latter stages?
Well, you've got to take each round and each game as it comes. But, you know, in England's favour, certainly that their games may not be as tough when it comes to their opponents as on the other side. Because if you're Belgium or Italy, you've got to do the hard way. You know, Belgium had to beat Portugal, they may have to beat Italy, and they may have to beat Spain to even get to the final. So Belgium has to do the hard way. And obviously, the harder the games are, the more it takes it out of you. So at the moment, I'd probably still be on the other half of the draw. I'd rather be in England's shoes than in Belgium's or Italy's. Having said that, that's no guarantee that it does get them to the final. And when they get to the final, I think at the moment, I would still favour Spain, Belgium or Italy, whoever gets there.
Okay.
Over England in the final.
And just a final question. I know that there's pictures doing the rounds today of the German squad either returning to Germany or heading off on their holidays, as it you know, tends to be. How will Joachim Löw's legacy be seen in Germany? You know, obviously a man who brought great success to the country, but is there a sense perhaps that he stayed on too long and he has damaged his long-term legacy with how they've ended in Euro 2020?
Yeah, I think he overstayed his welcome. You know, he's done ever so great for no reason whatsoever. His contract was extended before the World Cup in 2018. The German Federation got problems of their own now with the tax and everything else. So I don't think it was an option because they extended his contract before the World Cup 2018. So I don't think getting rid of the manager after the World Cup was an option. I think that it held us back for 3 years because we stood still now for the last 3 years. I was confident coming into the tournament. I think the showing against England was very disappointing. So have, two of the three games in the group stage. We did okay against Portugal. But overall, you've got to say he's done well for German football, but it certainly tarnished his legacy, what's happened in the last 3 years. He left Boateng, Hummels and Müller out 2 years ago. He sent him into exile, said he doesn't want them no more. Then he took two players back before the start of the tournament, which I think upset the group and disturbed the harmony of the group. I never had a feeling in this tournament that this was a group that's as united as it should be. And therefore, yes, he's done well for Germany, for the German national team, but certainly the last 3 years, tarnished his legacy.
Okay. Didi, enjoy the rest of the tournament. Thanks for being with us.
And you. Thank you. Pleasure.
Didi Haman joining us there. 51552 for your text at GameOn2FM. We'll get us on Twitter and we will. Will you ask Dietmar, is it coming home? I am sick of hearing the expression, is it coming home? Anyway, I'm also sick of the nostalgia around Italia 90 and all of this. Like, yeah, every.
It's sarcastic though, isn't it?
When it comes to these things. Yeah. God almighty. But like the other thing, getting texting during the week about like you should mark the anniversary of Ray Houghton's goal here or Ronnie Whelan's goal there. So Jesus, are we the greatest nation in the world for flogging the backside off nostalgic anniversaries?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it is. Some of it's just taking the fun, but I hope so anyway. But I absolutely agree with Didi there. I mean, there are four fascinating. So the quarterfinal stages are fascinating. But if you look at the way the draws have been split, I mean, it's certainly the easier route for England. Mm. I think a few weeks ago I was asked in here who did I fancy, and I said Italy, kind of on a whim, just because I've got a bit of a love affair with Italy. But I think they're definitely still in there with a shout if they can keep their passion going.
I was going to ask you before we take a break and get stuck into the Olympics. So Rafa Benitez presumably will do his first Everton press conference over the weekend, or if they're back pre-season training on Monday, it could well be Monday. And you know straight away one of the first questions is Rafa back in. Whenever it was, you referred to Everton as a small club. Mm. And then you were given the opportunity to clarify your statement in a second press conference, and he doubled down on his justification of Everton being a small club. He's going to have some weekend of trying to work out the semantics of how he talks his way out of that very quickly.
I'm sure he's been well paid for the issue anyway, isn't he? It's a funny thing. I mean, you talk about GA managers merry-go-round sometimes as well, but I mean, it's almost worse than the Premier League, do it? Just keep coming round and round.
Yeah, and come here, if he wins the first couple of games and they're challenging for Europe or they win a bit of silverware, he will be a hero on both sides of Merseyside for what he's done for each of the clubs. Anyway, plenty more to chat about. We're going to get stuck into the Olympics with Ian in 90 seconds. Stay with us. 2FM.
Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Fuel your day with Green Farm's new high protein cooked chicken breast fillets. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
And you're very welcome back to the programme. It's Damien O'Mara in the company of Ian O'Riordan. 51552 is the number for your text. That game on 2FM will get us on Twitter. So Ian, we're going through it here. I've a big list in front of me of all the Irish people destined for Tokyo. It's some testament to, like, the Olympic Federation of Ireland have obviously put great framework in place, but the independent and individual governing bodies, like, if we'd said leaving Rio that we will be back in, well, 5 years' time, with over 100 athletes qualified, it is a phenomenal achievement for a various range of sports in the country.
And you say 19 sports, and then you throw the pandemic into the mix as well, and all the uncertainty. And I mean, even up to a couple of weeks ago, let's be honest about it. I mean, you wake up some mornings kind of going, are these games going to happen? I can only imagine what that must have been like for the athletes. Some of whom, by the way, have benefited by the long break. I think that's fair to say. I mean, I mentioned early on Mark English. Okay, it was kind of a 12th-hour qualification, but he wasn't running well last year. He was kind of struggling a little bit. He's really got his mojo working, as he said himself. He ran 1:44.71 on Tuesday night to break the Irish record, which has stood for 26 years, I think it was, to David Matthews, one of the RT commentators here. And yeah, fair play to Dave, he's one of the first people to send Mark his congratulations. Looking through the list here, there's a few other I know, even, for example, in triathlon, for example, I think the guy's qualified, Russell White, and I think he'd broken his collarbone maybe March or April of last year. That would have ruled him out automatically.
Can you imagine what that must have been like? The agony of, like, just please cancel them.
Yeah,
hold it off.
Yes,
like, you know, it's such a strange headspace to be in.
Strange psychology, hoping they're cancelled. And there was a few others as well. I mean, looking at the list of athletes, I mean, but just looking at athletics for a moment, and the reason I mentioned the cutoff date on Tuesday night was that track and field, maybe more than any other sports, is probably the most complicated, convoluted kind of qualification process. Because obviously you've got the qualifying standards. If you hit a time, you're automatic. But you also have what's called the qualifying quota ranking system, whereby if you're within a certain quota, you can qualify for your events. Now, as it turned out, as it transpired, it was 50-50. We had 11 automatic qualifiers, and we had 11 then who got in on the ranking system, plus the 4x4 mixed relay team who are in as well. But looking at the list of names here, you've got Leon Reid, Marcus Lawler, Andrew Coscarran, Phil Healy, Nadia Power, Sheffrey Butner, Sarah Healy, David Kenny in the walk, Sarah Lavin in the hurdles, Ailish O'Flanagan in the steeplechase, and Louise Shanahan in the 800 metres. And these are all up-and-coming athletes. Mm-hmm. These are all kind of rising stars. I mean, the average age is probably 21, 22. There's a few older ones in there, but Sarah Healy is only 20. She's qualified for her first Olympics in the 1500 metres, a really tough event. I mentioned Sarah Lavin there as well in the 100 metre hurdles. She definitely would have missed out last year if the Olympics had happened, so it's worked to their advantage. Leon Reid as well is being nominated in the 200 metres. Now, there is a potential problem there with Leon Reid. I think it's been well aired at this stage.
And it's important, and we discussed this last week, that I think it's been well documented at this stage that Leon Reid is facing a legal process in the UK, and he's, you know, the right to his defence, and he's innocent until a court of law finds him otherwise. But it does leave not necessarily Athletics Ireland in a sticky position. It leaves the Olympic Federation of Ireland potentially in a sticky situation, because I'm not aware of anything that exists within their rules or their athlete participation agreement that would preclude him from competing subject to the legal process going on in the background.
No, not in terms of being in good standing. And the issue with Leon Reid was when the charges were first presented. Now, he's pleaded innocent to all these charges, obviously, but then they may have had to surrender his passport if he was considered a flight threat or whatever. Now, he hasn't.
But I presume then he was able to travel to Ireland to compete last week.
Oh yeah, no, he has his passport, so he's fine with that. And that's why, as far as I'm aware, there is no issue. Athletics Ireland have nominated him for a position, so it's up to the Olympic Federation. And look, I mean, Leon has been, we all know, he's had a bit troubled upbringing as well. We'd love to see him on that team. And I mentioned some of the names there, like Phil Healy. She's qualified in the 200, the 400, plus the mixed relay. That's the first woman in history to qualify for three events, by the way. So that's her first Olympics. So they're the ones who came through the ranking. Then the automatic qualifiers, I mentioned Mark English, Thomas Barr, who's actually running in Oslo tonight. He's in good form. Kieran McGeehan's been quiet, and then we have the marathon and the walk. So it's certainly one of the most very team. The only problem is there's not having great representation on the field events, which is disappointing. But that's just track and field. But certainly, if you look across the other sports I mentioned there, swimming, and I need to give a shout out as well for Ellen Walsh, who qualified at the last minute in the 200 metre medley. And there may have been an issue whether she was going to get nominated as well, because she wasn't originally on the list. I believe she's been put forward now as well. So it's exciting times for all these athletes. And funny enough, we were just talking this morning with Liam Jagu, who's going in the canoe slalom. and he was actually one of the first athletes to qualify. I think it was late 2019
yeah,
when
it's
he was
such a weight.
It's almost nearly
it's
best part.
It's a lifetime ago,
and he's also one of the first to go because he's traveling out on Sunday, I think, to get there. So he's got about a 2 week journey to get there. He's also out, I think, on the first day. Mm. So when his event is over, he has to leave within 24 hours because that's part of the COVID guidelines.
David Gillick was with us a couple of weeks ago, and we were chatting about the fact that, you know, it's like the holding camps are now largely irrelevant because a lot of athletes aren't going to want to go and have to hang around too long and then go in. But for a lot of them, it's almost replicating what they're used to from those who compete in the Diamond League or those who regularly compete in events where it's land in a day or two beforehand, compete and get out of town straight away. That he was making the point that for some, it will actually benefit them far more because this thing of, I'm just going to try and normalise the Olympics and approach it like any other event, that goes out the window for me the minute you look at your singlet and you see those five rings on it, because how can you normalise what it is you're competing in?
Yeah, no, I agree. It's unprecedented in so many levels in terms of how athletes will respond. But I think the benefit of being, and again, talking to a few of the athletes, like in terms of crowds in the stadium or not, a lot of the time you don't notice, or you shouldn't be noticing how many crowds are in the stadium if you're truly tuned into your event. And obviously, you throw in the likes of golf in there as well. I mentioned the rowing, the sailing, taekwondo, the young guy called Jack Woolley. Now, he's been very smart about how he's gone about it, because he's been trying to get his ranking up as high as possible so he can get a really top seed when he goes into the games. And they've managed to do that. So he kind of avoids all the main threats until he gets maybe to a medal bout. That's encouraging for him. Boxing as well. I mean, the Kelly Harrington story alone, I think, has been heroic. And by the way, I don't know if you've been watching the documentary by Dara Bambrick and RT.
It's
Tokyo Horizon. Well worth watching on the RT player, because he basically followed Kelly around for the best part of 2 years. And up until 3 or 4 weeks ago, she wasn't even sure if she'd even get the chance to qualify, let alone go.
Yeah.
And now I think she's a real medal hope. And it's just been an amazing story. It's an amazing journey for so many athletes. And look, they're not quite there yet. Well, and I mentioned the whole COVID stuff they've still got to get through. But in terms of the representation, I think, as you say, we have to credit the Olympic Federation of Ireland here. They've put the athlete first. We're still only 4 or 5 years out from, dare I say, the Pat Hickey OCI scandal of Rio, when the, let's be honest, the Olympic Federation was seen as considered toxic in some ways, and nobody would go near it. I think they've really turned that around, and they've kind of rebranded it as Team Ireland. They put the athletes first, and there's no doubt now that these athletes have been given every opportunity to qualify, and I think we're seeing the end result of that now.
The other thing that I'm looking forward to is, like, I was at 4 of the hockey matches in Rio, and just the dynamic of having a team, like, you know, we talk about the boxers being a team, but they're not really, they're individual athletes who are clustered in together. But you know, you look at like the rugby sevens and the hockey, it changes the dynamic of it so much. Like, they're the ones I'm really looking forward to. But you're talking about how the delay has benefited some athletes. I'm thinking of people like Megan Fraser, Nikki Evans, who, had it been last year, had it been that bit closer to the World Cup heroics from a couple of years ago, they'd probably be Tokyo bound. Whereas you look at the competitive nature of just being able to name, 16 players and 2 reserves, and you're like, it's so difficult.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, it's worked to a disadvantage for some athletes as well. And I forgot about the rugby sevens. And look, I think that was one of the success stories, because from what I can see, and I mean, I don't think I'm exaggerating here, it's quite a level playing field in rugby sevens. You know, you can really can't beat anyone else on any given day, because it's such a fast-paced game.
But it comes back as well that you look at, like, and people lament where, say, the women's 15s game has gone, and you look at it and say that is a sport where a framework and investment and a plan was put in place, and they have now reaped the benefit where they've, you know, they're competing regularly on the HSBC series, they've now qualified for the Olympics. And surely that has to be a lesson, not just for the IRFU, but for a lot of other bodies, about, like, how many people for whom has the long-term planning for Paris already begun? Or is it a case of, well, let's get a delayed Tokyo out of the way, and then we'll reconvene a couple of months later and start planning for what's coming down the tracks in 3 years.
Certainly setting the standard, all right. Yeah, and I mentioned some of the athletes there, the young athletes who are coming through. And look, I mean, I'm not going to name names here, but a lot of them are going there for the experience. You know, if they get through the qualifying round, it'll be great. I mean, winning a medal on the track, I mean, don't forget, the last medal we won on the track, Sonia O'Sullivan in 2000. Now, obviously, we've had Rob Heffernan in the walk, but that's over 20 years ago now. The medals in the track and field don't come around very often at all. But Thomas Barr, you mentioned Thomas Barr. He was running tonight in Oslo. I'd like to see how he goes on there. But he's ran his third fastest time there a couple of weeks ago. And Thomas is one of these guys, if he gets into the final, I know it's the ultimate cliche, but anything is possible. His event, unfortunately, right now, is probably one of the most competitive events in the world. The 400-meter hurdles, we've seen a guy come within 0.2 of the world record there during the US Olympic trials. So many other events as well. I think we're going to see world records for sure in Tokyo, despite the conditions. But I don't know. I'm still in mixed feelings about the crowd, whether you should let spectators in or not, whether it's a wise thing to do, number one, and whether it would make a difference if you have a sort of a small handful of people in a stadium, or would it kind of almost re-emphasise the fact that it's not a normal Olympics when you only have pockets of crowds.
Looking at the quotes last week where the chief medical advisor is saying, my advice is leave it behind closed doors. Obviously, the head of the organising committee is saying, well, if soccer have managed to do it, if basketball has managed to do it in recent times, why can't we do it? You're kind of wondering to yourself, like, if you were to get some great Japanese story, how great it would be to have that atmosphere in the stadium. But aside from that, you're wondering, is it really going to add to it that much if, you know, I don't want to say the inconvenience, but the potential trap falls of what it is might happen as a result of having people in a situation where a very significant part of the population hasn't been vaccinated at all yet.
Yeah, and that's the reality on the ground in Japan, unfortunately. Like, there, I think they're one of the poorest countries in terms of the numbers, in terms of vaccinations at this stage. And there's a whole variety of reasons for that we may not go into. But as you say, this is the first time it actually dawned on me that it's this month's Olympics, and you know that's how quick they're coming on fast. And I know there's so much sport going on at the moment, but I do think when they actually begin, there will be huge engagement level just because of the Irish interest and the curiosity as to how these games are going to unfold on so many levels. But it's as you say, it's just great to have 19 sports. I'm not quite sure how the seven horses are going to get there, but I'm sure they've got quite a journey ahead of them too.
I tell you, there's fellas who know far more about this than you or I are planning all that and are paid big money to worry about all that. So we'll wish them well with that. We've got a break to take, and then we're going to chat about the opening day of the Dubai Duty Free Irish Open with Greg after this.
Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Green Farm's new cooked chicken breast fillets are 100% natural and packed with protein. Available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on. Go.
And you're very welcome back to the programme. Before we chat to Greg at Mount Juliet News, reaching us, the permitted number of fans allowed to attend Sunday's Clare Tipperary game in the Munster Hurling Championship has increased from 200 to 3,000 in the space of a couple of days. The Munster Hurling semi-final has been added to the list of test events. It means 3,000 spectators will be allowed to attend the game at the LIT Gaelic grounds. The Leinster Senior Hurling semi-final doubleheader at Croke Park on Saturday and the First Division clash of Bray Wanderers and Cove Ramblers at the Carlisle grounds have all been confirmed as pilot events, which, Ian, it is quite the jump in the space of a couple of days from 200 to 3,000.
Well, that's given as one of these, as you say, pilot test events, which we've seen in a few events. I actually thought that match was designated a pilot test event, to the best of my knowledge, and I'm open to clarification there. I know they've been changing them and they've been adding them to the list, which is fine, but certainly good news for Clare Tip supporters. And I mean, and as you mentioned early on, now once the tickets go on sale, it's a proper ticket rush, isn't it? In terms of, I'd say the players are turning off their phones and the managers are turning off their phones at the stage, saying, "Look, don't come to me looking for a ticket, because it's going to be, look, it's been a long wait, and I've attended enough matches over the last year or two where there's been no fans there, and even having a few back has been great. But this is long overdue. Yeah. And I think as long as it's handled in the correct way, there's no reason why you can't get 3,000 people.
Pressure in life is when your 9-year-old finds out that there's 6,000 fans allowed into the Bose Europa Conference game in 2 weeks' time, and daddy has to get tickets at 12 o'clock tomorrow. So if I don't turn up here tomorrow evening, you know it's because I failed my 9-year-old. So anyway, it's good to see. I think it's just good for society. You know, there's loads of people, sport is important. There's loads of people for whom sport is largely irrelevant. But if it's getting us back to some semblance of normality, I think most people will welcome it. Let's go to golf. Greg Allen joins us from Mount Juliet. Hiya, Greg.
Hi, Damien. How are you?
I feel like I'm doing the nation a disservice that I'm here chatting about the Olympics and athletics with Ian O'Riordan when I should really just thrown the fader open and left it to you.
Yeah, I thought Nationals last weekend, and I just had a thoroughly fantastic time at Nationals. I thought it was one of the best Nationals I've ever been at. A small amount of people that may have been in the stadium, but there was a terrific atmosphere. You can't beat Olympic qualification scenarios for really sharpening the edge of athletes' performance. And there was a lot of edginess, and we've seen it spill over, I think, into what will be now a very difficult few days as these nominations will be made for the Olympics. But it does look like we're going to have something in the region of 27 maybe athletes going to the Olympic Games, track and field athletes. I think only Sydney we had a bigger team, and there were a couple of relays in Sydney. So, you know, it's a tremendous reflection of the depth of Irish athletics right now.
Yeah, and long may it last. We'll be chatting about that in greater detail between now and the Olympics getting underway on the 23rd of July. Your focus, and understandably so, is on Mount Juliet, the opening day of the Dubai Duty Free Irish Open. I think one or two stragglers still out on course. So Lucas Herbert, the man to catch, Greg, at 8 under par.
Yeah, he's a very proficient Australian player, and he could well be the winner on Sunday. He's that proficient consistently in the world's top 100, and he's at the moment the leader on 8 under par after a round of 64, and he's leading at the moment by 2 strokes from Grant Forrest, the Scot, who shot a round of 66, and also Johannes Vermeer, who's an American, who's 6 under par after 16 holes. It's really the group on 5 under that catches the attention, although Lucas Herbert has got terrific credentials to be right in contention all the way. I think, you know, the presence of the likes of Martin Kaymer, 2-time major winner after a round of 67, and he missed a tiddler on his final hole. It was the 9th green that he finished on, having teed off on the 10th, no more than 4 feet for birdie there. That would have taken him into a tie for second place on 6 under. So Kaymer, who's playing well recently, he's 5 under after that 67. Thomas Dietrich, a World Cup winner for Belgium, 5 under after 67. Andy Sullivan, Ryder Cup player from 2016, 5 under after 67. Nicholas Cosarts, Ryder Cup player from 2012, one of the heroes of that Miracle of Medina team. He's a 5 under after 18 holes today. Torbjörn Olesen, also Ryder Cup player, and who's on that mark of 67. Tommy Fleetwood, 67, who's the second highest player in the world rankings here. So look, it's a really, really deep group tied for 4th place on 5 under par, and it numbers no fewer at the moment than 16 players. So it's such a condensed leaderboard. Last time I counted, there were 90 players under par figures and over 50 in the 60s today, and unfortunately not very many Irish. 16 Irish players are playing here, only 3 are under par figures. The best of them though is going really well. The former tour player who's a club pro now in Athlone, in Glasson and Athlone, Colin Moriarty, often plays well in Irish Opens, and he is 5 under par playing the 18th. Also today we saw good rounds, has to be said, by certainly Niall Carney, who's in form at the moment, 12th in the BMW International in Germany last week, so 1 under par 71 for Niall Carney. And for Shane Lowry, a round of 2 under par 70. Now, Lowry, he's only home about a week after 6 months in America. He said he suffered quite a lot of jet lag coming back from the United States Open on the far side of America in the West Coast, an 8-hour time difference. But he was pretty solid today. And I spoke to him afterwards just about how solid a round and how solid a start he made with that 2 under par 70.
I felt like I had full control of my ball for the most of the day today. I felt pretty good out there. It was nice to be out there playing in front of a few Irish people, and I wouldn't say I'm pretty happy with it. I'll go in and have a look at what the scoring's like. I'm pretty sure the scoring's all right. Move on now and try and do a low score tomorrow and get myself in the condition for the weekend.
The crowd out there, and there was a crowd, thousands. Yeah. Nice to have that sunny Irish summer day with a real Irish crowd again.
Yeah, it's nice. You know, obviously myself and Padraig were paired, you know, in 2 groups. And look, obviously there's only a small amount of people, but it felt like a lot of them were with us. And there was a bit of a buzz out there. There was a bit of excitement, which was nice.
Olympics is on the horizon, and I just heard out in the course there's a few friends and family members, and I believe your brother Alan's going to be caddying for you at the Olympics.
He is, yeah. We decided that months ago. I asked him, I talked to Bo about it, and I asked him. He's obviously, he caddied for me before and done a great job. We had a good run in America. But it'll be nice to have him at the Olympics, and it'll be amazing to go there and try and win a medal with him and enjoy the whole experience of it.
Yeah, certainly one to relish. So Shane Lowry 2 under par after today, Niall Carney 1 under par, and I think, Greg, probably the big draw of the day, Rory McIlroy is back on level par.
Yeah, the big draw of the day, and it was terrific to see the galleries out here. There is a limit here of 5,000 inside the gates of Mount Juliet, but only 2,500 spectators in terms of paying spectators. There are an awful lot of people who are obviously residents inside here of Mount Juliet, and there are workers on the ground, there are media like me, there are officials, there are caddies, and there's players. So it really felt like an Irish Open, because it's amazing how big the gallery was around Rory. I don't think there was too many people anywhere else on the golf course for the afternoon following him. And he didn't really get off to any good, anyway, good start. He bogeyed the second hole, he also bogeyed the sixth, and then on the par 5 eighth, a hole that he'd hoped to get a shot back and perhaps get into it, he made another bogey there. But he was two over at the turn, and then showed briefly, you know, what that type of form that we can see from Rory with his birdies on 10 and also on 13. But on the way in, he did extremely well to save par on 17, where he went into the water off the tee, saved par on 18, the long par 4, 480-yard par 4, famous par 4 finishing hole out of the bunker on the left-hand side of the green. So McIlroy signed for a level par 72, and it was that type of day when he felt he really couldn't get anything going.
Yeah, it was a funny day. I just couldn't really get anything going. I don't really know. I don't really put a finger on. I had a few iron shots left. I know that, so I'm going to go to the range after this and work on a couple of things. But apart from that, it wasn't like, you know, the putts that I did miss, I hit good putts and I misread them, or they didn't do what I thought they were going to do. It was just one of those days. I just didn't get anything going. But, you know, as I said, it could have been worse. I saved par the last three holes and, you know, at least got in at even par and, you know, can get a good night's sleep tonight and get out fresh in the morning. And, you know, it's obviously out there. Tommy played a very solid round of golf, didn't really do anything spectacular and shot 500 par. So, you know, there are scores to be had out there.
Will you put a number on what you might need tomorrow to feel like you're in contention, because it looks as though the scoring will be very, very low this weekend?
Yeah, I just need to play better, and you know, if I play better, I'll shoot a better score. So I think it's a bit early in the tournament to start to try to shoot certain scores and see what I need, and if, you know, if I play better tomorrow, I'll shoot a better score and we'll go from there.
Rory McIlroy chatting after his round today. Greg, we've so many Irish players involved, as one would expect with the domestic staging of a big European Tour event like this. And another man, we've heard from two previous champions. Let's hear from a third previous champion and another man for whom the Irish Open is very much a priority every year. Padraig Harrington, but he's a long way back on the leaderboard.
Yeah, 139th place out of 156. That's not what we expected from the man who was fourth in the PGA Championship, showing such brilliant form at Kiawah Island in the second major of the year in May. So Harrington, you know, came here, I think, really expecting that he was going to play well. He's played Mount Juliet. He knows this place very well from the two American Express World Golf Championships, albeit back in 2002 and 2004. But he has a good feel for the place. And he gave this very curious explanation today for what happened in his seven bogey round of four over par 76.
I suffered a bit from playing too well in practice. That happens sometimes, and doing a few new things, you go on the golf course, is slightly different and it gets a little harder to do. But I stuck at it, didn't change, and just kept at it. And unfortunately, we'll see how we get on tomorrow. But hit some really pure shots. Lots of good. Score was bad, but you know, it was one of those days when it came to scoring. I couldn't seem to get in the right place at all, and then struggled a bit on the greens. That's kind of one of those days when it comes to the scoring, but plenty of positives.
And Greg, you can really hear the disappointment in his voice, because this does mean so much to him.
Yes, his 26th consecutive Irish Open. Padraig turned up last year in Galgorm Castle. It was his first event after 7 months in lockdown, and he missed the cut there. But since the Irish Open last year in Galgorm, he's gone on a real run, and he's gone from outside the top 400 in the world rankings to inside the top 200 in the world rankings. So, you know, Padraig expected an awful lot more, so he's very disappointed that he's got off to that kind of round, and he's left him so far back with the scoring today that I think he might need something in the region of 64, 65, 66 because tomorrow to have a chance of making the cut, because this cut could be 2 under, 3 under, or 4 under. Depending on how the conditions are tomorrow. So he's really behind the 8 ball. Not just Padraig struggling today. We saw Graham McDowell at 2 over par round of 74. His struggles are continuing. Paul Dunne got back a late birdie to make it a level par 72. But the only Irish players under par are Colin Moriarty, who's just finished now. He's bogeyed 18, Moriarty. But he's still the leading Irish player on 4 under par after a round of 68. Lowry tied for 56th place, even though he shot a 2 under par round. 55 players at the moment are in the territory of 3 under par or better, so we're looking at that many players in the 60s. And Niall Carney, as I said, in form at the moment, and certainly a big paycheck this week, because there's a €3 million prize fund here. If Carney could pick up a top 20 here, it will go a long way to securing his card in terms of, you know, this is a player who's been around since 2009 in professional golf. We've seen a breakthrough this season. It's a rare thing that a player so long knocking around the Challenge Tour, Euro Pro Tours, can do this, can find form, and maybe get a main tour card, but it's possible for Niall Carney with a high finish this week that he can almost secure his card. And incidentally, a player who's actually secured his card for another year and has shown an example to Niall Carney, Jonathan Caldwell, who won recently in Scandinavia and has secured his playing rights in the European Tour for well over a year. He actually had a poor round today and he shot a round of 76. So it was just a day when nobody seemed to really find, you know, their mojo, except for Colin Moriarty, who's a club professional, has to be said these days. Former tour professional, very solid player, and he's posted that 68, and it's the best Irish round of the day. But as I said, the lead is held by Lucas Herbert, an Australian who shot an 8 under par 64, and he's not to be underestimated. He's the world's number 91 ranked player, and Herbert has also been top 20 on the PGA Tour in America on his last two starts at the Travelers Championship and also at the Memorial. So he is a man to watch on 8 under par 64 with a 2-shot lead over the field right now.
Greg, all to play for across the weekend. Look forward to chatting to you again tomorrow. Thanks for being with us. Greg Allen with us there from Juliet, and coverage of course of the Dubai Duty Free Irish Open and RT television and radio over the coming days. Break to take, back in a moment. 2FM.
Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Healthy dinners made easy with Green Farm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillets range, available in selected stores nationwide.
The man open left. Game on Iron America.
And you're welcome back to the program. We are tight on time, but we've always enough time in our day to fit in everybody's favorite American. Shep, how are you?
Wow, that is, I don't know what that says about my country, but I'll take it.
No, it says more about you than it does about the country. That's trustworthy. All right. You know? Come here, we've a lot to get into in a very short space of time. Today is an anniversary that the Mets would like to forget, but actually managed to celebrate with quite some level of enthusiasm.
Well, yeah, it's just hysterical. It's Bobby Bonilla Day is what July 1st is. The short of it is they signed a contract with him that they were going to defer some of the money that they owned him about 20 years ago. And every July 1st, they pay him $1.2 million. And they have done it for like the last 20 years. And they will continue to do it for the next about 15 years. And so instead of paying him $5 million 20 years ago, they're going to wind up paying him $27, $28, $30 million. Because that is the power of compound interest, children.
But does the franchise themselves celebrate what is a horrific financial decision, or is it just something that's been appropriated by the fans?
So they used to not celebrate it, but they are under a new ownership, and the guy has kind of embraced it as a bit of a joke. And so they actually today used it. They used Bobby Bonilla in an ad to let people know that they can start spending the night at Citi Field in an Airbnb ad. So they had Bobby Bonilla talking about, you know, put in your bids to stay at Citi Field, you know, have a birthday party and spend the night or do whatever it is that you want to do. So they are trying to find a way to capitalize on a very bad business decision from 20 years ago.
Yeah, and you would wonder, did he get a fee for partaking in the ad, having already creamed what he's going to cream until the age of 72? Away from that, we touched upon this last week, but just to recap, a significant day in college sport, and a lot of young men and women around the US who will notionally go to bed tonight as paupers on student grants will wake up tomorrow morning as potentially multi-billionaires.
Yeah, so it happened. It happened overnight. Today's July 1st, and the rules changed in a lot of these states. And when I say it happened overnight, there was a signing at 12:01 Eastern Time in New York in a hotel lobby between a football player at Jackson State University here in Mississippi and a company that does barbershops and barber equipment, primarily, you know, targeted towards African Americans, and he signed, you know, a contract to be with them. There's a gymnast at LSU who has 1 million Instagram followers, and they're expecting her to make a ton of money today. There's these twins out in California that play basketball for Fresno State. They became the spokeswomen for Boost Mobile this morning at a ceremony in Times Square. And so the thing of, you know, I am a broke college athlete and I don't have the ability to make any money, even though the school makes the money off me, those days are over. And so it could be anywhere as big as the deals that I'm talking about to you go to a smaller school and a local company wants to give you $5,000 to do something. Well, you'll probably take it and go advertising. You know, there are a couple of restrictions But still, it is a new day when it comes to college athletics in America.
Ian, Shep, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks for being with us. Ian, you were a man who'd got a scholarship. If only you could roll the years back.
20 years too late, exactly. God, even just to get a local car to drive around would have made a huge difference.
Yeah, there we go. How times change. Apologies to Tara. We're miles over on time. Stand by for her from all of us here. Until tomorrow, good night.
Live across the nation, this is RTE 2FM.